Yeah, no problem. And I think Brad's got the same situation. So...
Can I go to that, too? Whatever.
We have no work session for today, right?
No.
Trust okay.
You don't want us to go?
Hey.
You'll be much happier here in this meeting.
Let's call the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources together. Today is the 2nd of March. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2179. Ask Representative Stark to join. In fact, Mr. Honeycutt, do you want to come up at the same time just for... transit.
May Mr. Buma join us as well?
I could, although I was thinking about the fact that I'm missing a button and how awkward that is, but now that I set it on the mic, I might as well just come down there.
That's what happens when we have a delay.
Just eat the rest.
So I'm confused. What are we doing?
It's basically a public hearing.
Oh, okay. 79. Did he open a public hearing?
He did.
Okay. So do you want to say anything, or is he going to set up the bill?
No, he's going to set it up.
So you can talk after.
Representative Klim, even though you have no button on your shirt, would you kick us off, please?
Improperly dressed. I just don't know if this is okay.
I can see already.
Oh, yes. Well, good morning, Chair Klim and Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. And today, with me, I have Wayne Buma, constituent. He is a wastewater handler. He owns a business called AAA Advanced Septic. He'll share all about that in just a little while. And Dave Honeycutt will be up here in a couple minutes as the President of Oregonians in Action. And, you know, I know it's early in the morning, and I apologize ahead of time if we have too many puns on this bill. It kind of just lends itself to that. And quite frankly, for an 8:30 bill, 8:30 committee, this is probably the crappiest bill you're ever going to have to deal with in here. So, and why would I say that? Well, because today we are talking about biosolids. Yes, that's right, human manure. Human manure and also humanure, that's even the simpler way of saying it. It's long since been established throughout the world, since the beginning of time, that humanure, you can have some good uses of it. In fact, not too long ago, I was in Machu Picchu, and did you know that entire ancient civilization, they have one bathroom there? Only the king had a bathroom in this house. The rest of them knew, hey, the best way to deal with this stuff is to go out in the forest. It's good for the environment. Anyway, we've progressed quite a bit since then, and I'm digressing. So what are we doing here? Currently, Oregon law, and ORS Chapter 215 allows the application of biosolids to specific types of lands, DEQ, right, DEQ?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. These guys are here because I'm probably going to mess this up. This is not my specialty. Allows biosolids to be applied to specific types of farmland. Mm-hmm. Usually your cattle, grain type lands. There's a lot of restrictions on it already. And that's where we come to ORS Chapter 215, which has some differences in how you can interpret that. And when you look at ORS Chapter 215, you see that it says, you know, that this can be applied on land. That's really not the debate. The matter of interpretation gets into whether or not it can be treated at the site of application. And that becomes a big deal. And that's what my constituent here will talk about in just a couple minutes. So now think about the reality of this, though. If you don't allow it to be treated at the site of location, that's somewhat of the national norm and even the state norm, but different counties interpret this differently, and that's why we want to clarify it in this bill. If you don't, then your options are, you have a few options. One, you can treat it when you collect it. So you collect from a septic tank, and it's actually really, really hands-on and involved, and it's pretty hazardous for the person doing it. Not the ideal way to treat it, but currently, no question, you can treat it when you collect it. Or you can also go out and build big facilities in order to store it and treat it there. Okay, and that requires a lot of land or land use, a lot of things involved in that, expensive buildings, expensive permits, and that sort of thing. Or really one of the most effective ways is to collect it into your appropriate collection bin. He can tell you the proper terminology for this. Transport it to where it's going to be land applied and treat it there before applying it. That's the simplest, one of the most effective ways of doing that. So, and a consequence of not doing that currently, and again, Wayne can share with you in a minute if I'm not stealing all of his thunder here, is that if you don't So if you don't treat it there, then you can end up shipping it off to these other locations that can actually get overflowing, and you can end up with an issue with the amount of, that's stored in a spot, and then they start getting to the point of, where do we actually store this stuff? Okay, so the most beneficial, wisest way to do this is to treat it when you're applying it, or treat it and then apply it. So that brings us to House Bill 2179. What we want to do here is basically, it's a matter of about 10 words in two different spots. We want to clarify that in addition to being able to apply it to these different sites, that you can also treat it at the time of application and then apply it. And now the county that originally was interpreting this differently, and my constituent will tell you about that in just a moment, to my understanding, they've actually gone to the point of being supportive of this bill. Okay, I haven't talked to them directly, but I've been told that. And so that might beg the question of, well, then do we need the bill? Yes, we still need the bill, even if they kind of change their local rules. We want to clarify for the state, from any counties, from misinterpreting this from now on and moving forward, that, hey, look, this is the wise thing to do. It's the environmentally friendly thing to do. Let's get this done. So I do want to give you a heads up that there is an amendment coming that is not back yet. As some people took a look at this, we realized, oh, when we say treatment, we're not talking about building big treatment plants all over the place. We're talking about these portable treatment units like Wayne has. And so that's what this is all about. I held off on too many puns.
Yeah,
can I steal your... Yeah. Yeah, we got some good ones.
Madam Chair, members of the record, I'm Brian Clem. State Representative from District 21. I promise this won't be a waste of you. I hate puns, actually. They're the lowest form of humor, so I'm not going to do them at all. Sorry, bud. So for me, at least, the general issue of where you process agricultural-related things is kind of a bigger issue, because our land use system largely implies that you should do processing and industrial-type things inside urban growth boundaries, but that means more truck miles, more vehicles on the road and more carbon footprint if you're doing things away from the source of the material, whether it's mills as for processing logs. If they're in town and the trees are off in the woods, there's a lot of log trucks on the road. And so generally there's kind of always a question in my mind of how much activity should you have on farmland when you're processing farm materials versus having to go inside the urban growth boundary, which is sort of what our system calls for. In this case, it's much easier because we're talking portable facilities, so it's not displacing acreage permanently with processing facilities. It's portable. So to me, this is one of those times where a county sees it differently. Sometimes just the introduction of the bill ends up changing the situation for the particular person. That may be the case here. But generally speaking, I think it's a good thing to have processing done. If it's not displacing farmland and paving over good parts of an acreage for processing, I think it's good to have the processing as close to the source of the material as possible. I think this one's kind of a no-brainer. So I'm not going to go on much further and let Roshan Stark's constituent talk specifically about what he's encountered at his place, and I'll go back up there.
Thank you for joining us.
Please.
Chair, Reverend Clam, thank you for hearing me. I'm Wayne Buma, and I have a business of wastewater handling out of Southern Oregon in Jackson County. As was said, the problem I ran into was through the county was when I go to, after I collect septages on sites from different individuals, I have to take that septage to a DEQ approved site and then land apply. The problem was the county, the way they have it worded, wouldn't allow me to treat that septage on the same site that I wanted to land apply on. So the problem would be then is I would, in order when I collect my septage on each individual site, that's if someone gives me a call and says, hey, I need my tank pumped, that's what I mean by each individual place. I would have to, at that point, when I collect that septage on that site, I would have to treat it there. Now, treatment, when I say treatment, it means it's an agricultural lime. It's a stable product. It's not some hazmat material. What you're doing is you just need to treat the septage, because when you collect the septage, it runs about a pH of about 6 to 7. The DEQ says you have to bring the pH to a 12 before you can land apply. So the problem was I had to then treat it on each individual place. What I'd like to do is take that septage and bring it to the DEQ approved place where I land apply. That way I could filter it there. There's two things going on. You have to filter it and you have to treat it with lime. So I'd like to take that septage to that place where I can land apply and then treat it there as well as filter it. You have to filter it because there's plastics and things that can't go on the ground after you when you go to land apply. So you first treat it, hold it at 12, a pH of 12, and then you filter it, and then you can land apply it. Right now it's bottlenecked. The county would not allow me to do this process of treating and separating right there on the property that I'm land applying on. So it's not working well. So I needed to change this so that I could go ahead and treat and filter on that piece of property that I'm going to land apply on. And that's what this is about.
Honeycutt? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here in support of House Bill 2179. This is a small bill in the grand scheme of things, but it's important for folks like Mr. Buma. So, you know, this is a nice little bill that helps out a nice family business in Jackson County. We have amendments to the bill. The bill as currently drafted is a little bit broad. It makes changes to two particular statutes, 215, 213, and 215, 283. Those are the statutes that authorize non-farm uses in EFU zones. So this bill would apply to EFU zones. The reason there's two statutes, 215, 213 applies to Lane and Washington counties. 215, 283 applies to the other 34 counties. It goes back to marginal lands in the early 90s. So that's why there's two particular statutes that we're amending. But what the amendments will do is they will narrow the scope of the bill to make it clear that what we're talking about is the treatment of biosolids on site using portable temporary treatment facilities, which can be transported by truck trailer. So Mr. Buma will get his DEQ permit. DEQ will come out and make sure that everything is environmentally safe, issue him his permit, and then he can use his portable equipment, and instead of having to treat at multiple sites, he can go to the site where DEQ has approved the site for the land application, treat on site, and then apply. That's all this bill does. It's a good bill. I urge the committee's support.
Questions? Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are some of the agricultural applications for this? Because I heard Representative Stark talk about not this and this and this, which made sense. What is an application?
It is fertilizer and water by the time when you get it treated. So what they're using it for is for cattle grazing type of ground. And it's also used for growing feed for cattle is the two main things. It can't be used for direct human consumption. Like you can't put it down and grow lettuce or carrots or something like that. It's not. It's for agricultural use for cattle mostly, yeah.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McClain.
Yes, this bill is like 33 pages long, and so what the amendment does is actually specify for only this type of situation. It's not opening up the door and making it wider for all uses that might be happening on ag land, but is primarily just in this situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative or Vice Chair McClain, that's correct. It's a long bill because we've got a long list of uses. The only change under the bill is to subsection 1Y of 215, 213, and 1V of 215, 283. The proposed amendments, which we have at LC, but we just don't have them back yet, would only amend those two particular subsections that deal with the biosolid application.
Right, and so that specifically means that everything else that's listed there is going to stay as is.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair McClain, correct.
And then my second question is, everybody's trying to be creative with resources. and we all know whether it be water or anything else. And so like in my neck of the woods, we have a treatment plant where they're actually filtering and using the water to make beer. And there's actually been some national coverage of this. So, you know, doing something like this, you know, makes sense if we're using it for, like you said, non-food uses because of what you're using but or how you're treating it. So the only other question I have is safety, and that is that DEQ has agreed that the application, putting it on that particular field and using your processing at that site does not weaken the processing, nor does it in any way have any safety issues. Okay.
Representative Power.
Yeah, so previous to me joining the House of Representatives, I was part of my county wastewater treatment committee, so I know pretty deeply how that process happens and how at the end product a lot of our urban areas have developed land application products for Eastern Oregon and others. And I agree with you, the trucking back and forth around is not particularly environmentally friendly nor necessarily cost effective. So I'm really interested in the mechanics, how it works. Can you explain to me how DEQ's oversight of this would work on a more modular traveling basis with the kind of tools you're talking about? How would they test it to make sure that the land application is still environmentally sound and not containing anything that would, pose a health to or pose harm to human health or anything along those means?
Chair Klim, Representative Powers, and Vice Chair McLean, to those questions, this might be a good time for the Farm Bureau to join in on this conversation. Sure. It's my understanding they're here to testify, and they probably have additional knowledge on this. So I will move aside, and if it's okay with the chair, have them come.
Mary Ann can join us. And do you want to take a stab at the question as well for your operation?
Yes, Chair Klim and Power. this is all going to be done with wheeled vehicles, so to speak. It's all implements. What they have normally have seen before is fixed base operations, means concrete, power, all that. What I would be doing is when I collect the septage with a truck, I would take it to the site where I'm going to land apply. It goes into a trailer that's got basically a screening process inside this trailer. It's a dump trailer. And the septage gets put in the back of that. It runs through, it goes through a screening process. From there, it goes out of a valve out the back of the trailer and goes into a 10,000-gallon holding tank. So it's all screened, and as soon as it goes into that tank, it needs to now be treated. It needs to have the agricultural lime put in it. So I'd have a mixing operation where it just mixes water with the lime, and it's injected in that tank. Once it goes in the tank, I set up a blower. There's a pipe with these blower bars coming out across the whole bottom inside that tank. So you back the truck up to that 10,000-gallon tank, and you turn on a pressure, air pressure, and you blow inside that tank. And that mixes the lime with the septage. So as it's mixing, you take samples of it, of the septage at that point, and you test it and make sure it gets up to 12. If it hasn't got up to a pH of 12, you keep adding enough lime till it finally stabilizes at 12 for 30 minutes. Once it stabilizes at 12 for 30 minutes, then you can land apply. So then at that point, I pull it into the back side of the tank where there's a 6-inch valve. I load it onto a truck. The truck then goes out in the field, and it's got a spreader bar. And it's all it is a tank on the back of a truck, and there's an air valve that you, when you're sitting in the driver's seat, you're going through the field, you pull a valve, it opens up an air valve, and then there's a duct bill, it's called, that's on the back of the truck. The septage goes through, hits this duct bill, and spreads, and it goes across the field. Now, this has all been approved as far as the pHs and how it's spread, all that has all been DEQ approved. There's nothing new going on as far as the safety of what's going on and the pHs that it's supposed to be maintaining at. All that has all been covered. This is only, the question here is only how I do it on the site that I do it. So I've already had the DEQ's approval on this type of equipment that I've got set up well, I have. It's not set up on the property, but it's all been built. It's all been approved. That I, what I'm doing will work, and it's all approved through them. The county, the only time the county's got to get involved here is that I'm using the correct property to land apply on, and that's how the county gets involved, that it's got to be EFU property. So I'll be spreading on EFU property, which is exclusive farm use property. That's what EFU is. And then the oversight then is handed over to the DEQ. And the DEQ then at that point makes sure I'm applying correctly, that I'm using the pHs correctly, and everything is done in order.
I think the question is, like, how do they do that? Like, do they come and watch?
Yes, they do.
Every randomly, not every job, obviously. That'd be probably too expensive to have someone follow you around all the time. But they will occasionally come and check what you're doing.
That's correct.
Hmm. Interesting. Anybody else?
Yeah,
Representative Bretto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One question. I get the part where the lime, you know, reduces the pH. But what about bacteria? Does lime kill bacteria also, or is it rich in bacteria that it goes on the field?
Chair Upton Bredo, yes. What it does is it, when septage is in just a tank, it, like I said, it's between a 6 and 7 pH. But then when I lime treat it, it brings it up to 12. And 12, basically, if you want to look at it, it sterilizes it, so to speak. It purifies it. So it kills the bugs, kills any pathogens, kills bacteria, it kills all that, but it still maintains its integrity as a fertilizer. Currently, farmers use agricultural lime anyway on property when you have property that's too acidic, yeah. Like underneath trees, got really high acids and such. So this isn't a product that's being introduced that's not already being used on farm property, and it doesn't even, you can buy this lime and put it on. You don't have to have a permit. You can just put it on. There's nothing even there that's they're watchdogging for using lime.
Oh, Vice Chairman McLean.
Marianne, what about dairy farms? Are dairy farms doing the same kind of thing on site as far as treating the manure that they have there?
So, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, for the record, Marianne Nash from the Oregon Farm Bureau. And part of what I wanted to speak to on the bill is kind of the other side of regulation. Mm-hmm. This, I know this bill is about the land use component, and we definitely understand and sympathize with the issue that is being solved here. But I wanted to provide some of that clarification. So on dairy farms, all of that work is done under their CAFO permit. And yes, is there land applying animal byproduct? Part of what they do, it's similarly regulated, where they have to test soil levels and make sure that they're using at an agronomic rate and then it's actually being taken up into the plant and not causing other issues. And that was something I wanted to speak to here as well, is that is something that DEQ is very familiar working with ODA to ensure that that's going on, and they have provided both for regulated uses and some of the like food waste application and other smaller excluded uses. They have recently provided clarification to make sure that DEQ is consulting with ODA and making sure that applications are being done at an agronomic rate, so it's actually being utilized by the crop that you're growing and actually being taken up into the plant and not causing other concerns. And that is something that's been done through the CAFO program for a long time and something that they're very mindful of as they regulate other land applications of other types of waste. And for the Farm Bureau, we very much support this beneficial reuse of biosolids or other agricultural byproducts to make sure it helps farmers keep costs down in terms of buying soil amendments that they may otherwise have to purchase. It allows beneficial reuse of waste. And I think it is being done in the state in a way that is assuring that it's not causing a negative environmental impact, that the nutrients are actually being taken up into the plants and they are being utilized. And that is something that ODA is assisting DEQ with, determining exactly what those agronomic rates are and making sure the applications are being done in that way. And then ODA also retains authority under its water quality program to come out and tell the farmer, oh, if there's a concern or it's getting too close to a sensitive area, they say, okay, we want you to modify in this way to make sure that there isn't any, you know, surface water quality or other impacts. And so it is something that I think has been worked out over the years, and that DEQ is seeking appropriate advice from ODA to make sure that it is being done in an agronomically appropriate way.
Thank you. Answer my question.
Okay, any further questions? Okay. And you did you get everything you wanted to in?
Yes, the bill is amended. I think the amendment is appropriate to clarify that it's not a big new processing facility, but other than that, I think it's a worthy problem to solve, and I'm happy we're solving it.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2179 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2883 and ask Representative Helm to come and chat about his bill. You're following the poop bill, so.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ken Helm, State Representative from House District 34. I just came in on the end of your previous discussion, and I have to say that I have a new appreciation of what this committee is all about, I guess. So thanks for hearing my bill today. I appreciate it. You may remember that in 2016, Representative Krieger, Representative Witt, and myself chief sponsored a bill to crack down on poaching in our state, poaching of fish and wildlife. And there's a lot to be happy about there. That law is now in effect, and it's doing its work across the state. And since that time, I've been watching the news, particularly for instances of poaching that have been going on since. And it's not as if the new legislation is solving the problem overnight by any means. ODFW continues to report on egregious instances of poaching, wasting of elk, poaching of mule deer, exceeding limits of salmon and steelhead. It's still a huge endemic problem out in all of our counties around the state. And with that in mind, I was really shocked this summer as I sat with my parents in Bend reading the morning newspaper to read a story about a guide, a registered outfitter, somebody who's supposed to know and abide by the rules himself and make sure that his clients follow the rules, be convicted by a circuit court under some of the rules that we just established of poaching a trophy mule deer and trying to hide it, trying to hide the fact that he'd poached the deer and was waiting until the next season to obtain his tag. He was actually freezing the deer, I think, holding it in a freezer or refrigerator. And I thought, how can we tolerate our guides and outfitters being poachers if we won't allow and we're standing by the policy of the state to crack down on the ordinary fishing and hunting license holder? So that's the genesis of this bill. And what the bill essentially does is say, if you are an outfitter that's registered with the Marine Board, or you hold yourself out to be a registered outfitter, and you are convicted of knowingly and willfully, with culpable mental state, violating the wildlife laws of our state, and you're convicted, then that's it for you. You do not deserve to have an outfitter license in our state because you're not fit to impose on yourself and your clients the wildlife laws that everybody else abides by. You're supposed to be a caretaker of this public resource. So that's what the bill does. Pretty simple in its original form before you. In talking to stakeholder groups, I have discovered that the bill needs a couple of amendments that I'm in the process of having redrafted by legislative counsel. They get at the following issue. One, as it is, the bill only applies to registered outfitters that are already registered with the Marine Board. One amendment would change that to persons that hold themselves out fraudulently to their clients to be outfitters as well. That need came to my attention because we have another instance of a fellow in Central Oregon and his wife. They were holding themselves out to be outfitters. They were taking money from clients and poaching multiple species and multiple numbers of those species of mule deer and elk. We can't have that either. Not only are those folks committing a fraud on their customers, but they're violating our wildlife statutes. The other amendment that I'll be pursuing is that if an outfitter is convicted of violating wildlife laws and is suspended under or has his or her license revoked under this bill, that that person would not be able to circle around the statute and go to work for a licensed outfitter as an employee. We can't let that loophole exist either. So those are the two amendments that I'll be seeking. I think you'll be getting written testimony, if you don't have it already, from some of our folks that are concerned that this might be too much. It might be too rigorous a penalty, that we might be depriving folks that have started a business in this way from a chance to earn a living in the future by being an outfitter. And to that I say, if it is indeed the fact that under our current law, a person convicted in this way can return after only 2 years of being having their license revoked by the Marine Board, which is current law. If you get caught right now, you can come right back in 2 years and reapply to be an outfitter again. If that's the only prohibition, then we're not really providing much of a deterrent for these folks that are bad actors out there. So I think we can do better than that. I'm working with the same coalition that we worked with when we put forward the bill in 2016 with Representative Krieger and Representative Witt. They'll be speaking to you now about their perspective on this bill. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions before we go on.
Questions for Representative? Okay. Representative Barreto, and then
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right now, I mean, I was under the understanding that an outfitter can get his license revoked indefinitely on egregious violations. Is that correct,
Representative Barreto? I think what happens is that under ORS, let me give you the number. The Marine Board has the authority to revoke licenses, and I think it is theoretically possible that every 2 years, as these license applications come back in, they can revoke on a rolling basis. And we have folks from the Marine Board here that can clarify this for me. So it's theoretically possible to do that. And there's a whole list of types of crimes for which if an outfitter is convicted, that would qualify the Marine Board to revoke licenses because of. What we're saying here is that violation of the wildlife laws themselves are a special instance, because there's a special trust obligation of guides in this instance to abide by the laws for both themselves and their clients. So a lifetime ban is warranted.
Want to follow up?
Yeah, I was thinking one indefinite and then the severity, and I wasn't thinking of the Marine Board necessarily as much as Fish and Wildlife, you know, and you mentioned mule deer and elk, and yeah, I think some of those things are absolutely egregious. Lose their license and their opportunity to do business. There are other things where there's a mistake made or they covered up, but it's not necessarily intentional, like you said, or with malice or whatever. For instance, if they're out, if an outfitter has a client and he's out and the client shoots an elk or a deer or whatever, and then it doesn't go down, you know, and he sees another animal, he thinks it's the same one, he shoots it again, you know. I mean, these things are, I had a brother-in-law who did this a few years ago, but his wife shot an elk, he shot an elk, neither of them went down. He went over, they were both laying there, and he shot them both against the law, but yet he dispatched them both because they were both wounded and they're both dying, you know, against the law. But under this here, it seems like if he was an outfitter and he did that for a client, or the client shot, you know, two, then he would be subject to getting his license revoked.
Representative Barreto and Chair Clem, in this instance, that in my opinion, that would not occur, because this is not a bill about mistakes in the field. This is a bill about what happens after a court of competent jurisdiction makes their ruling. And in those cases where there is evidence of lack of intent, I don't think a court would reach that decision. This is not an automatic. This doesn't say what the court has to do in considering the facts of the case. This is saying what we want to do after a court has reached their decision. So mistakes will be taken care of by, and all the circumstantial evidence or and evidence that might be mitigating around a circumstance like that, the court can still take into account in exactly the same way that they do today.
Okay. Thank you.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions about specifically what the bill does or what we currently do. So as I'm looking at 415, it talks about, first thing it talks about, so current law is anybody, not just the guide, but anybody that applies, says here, no person who has had a license tag or permit revoked, and some other language here, shall apply or obtain a license for 36 months. And then the second time, it's 5 years. And then the third time, they're done, it looks like. So my question is, a couple questions. Number one, do we have a licensed guide who's been convicted of a game violation, currently holding a valid guide license? Do we have that issue that we need to solve? And it is certainly, unless I'm wrong, certainly within the purview of the judge as a matter of sentencing to say, you can't do this, I'm thinking. I think where you want to, I'm with where you want to get to. I think we're there. I really do. Maybe we're not. And then the other part of that, they can apply. But apply does not mean you will receive. So talk to me, it seems like we have three things in place to prevent this. And first, do we have a licensed guide that's been convicted of game violations currently in the state?
Yes, that instance, Representative Springer and Chair Clem. Yes, that instance that I gave you in the beginning, the mule deer that was poached by the guide. Yes, that's an instance that fits this law perfectly.
He has it. So after conviction, now he went and got a guide license, and he's a guide again?
I don't know whether he's guiding again or not, but he's entitled to under existing law.
It looks like he received a court suspension of hunting privileges for 3 years and guide registration for 2 years.
Yeah. So I think that answers the first question. The second question about the existing wildlife laws that we amended in 2015, sort of, I believe, and I don't have that statute in front of me, but I believe that's our sort of three strikes and you're out, which was developed by Representative Krieger and myself. That structure was intended to give folks a chance to change their behavior in case they made a mistake, in case they were, should have known the law but didn't. And by the time you get to that lifetime suspension, you're a habitual offender in that case. That's a different circumstance than here. Mm-hmm. It's just my feeling that the outfitters are expected to know the rules to protect their own clients. And if they're not doing that, then they need to find another job.
Yeah, follow. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So as I've looked at the bill and looking at ORS 497, what I'm not clear on yet, maybe you can help me with this, or I don't know. So in the summary, it talks about with culpable mental state, and that's what it says. And then I go through the bill, and maybe I've missed it. I've not seen culpable mental state specifically called out. And so when I look at 497, it talks about culpable mental state. The example that Representative Barreto gave, that the guy chose to shoot the animals and kill them so they didn't suffer, which we could argue was a good choice, mm-hmm. knowingly and willingly did it. So talk to me about culpable mental state and define it for me and show me where I'm missing where it's listed out.
Representative Springer and Chair Clem, I cannot remember whether it's in that statute or a related, but the culpable mental state isn't just defined. There are full sections that describe what it means in different circumstances, and they are embedded within the wildlife law itself. And that, those were changes that were made, I believe, in 2011. So even though I can't describe them to you right here, it's not a standalone defined term, either in this bill or elsewhere, but it's actually described in quite some detail, and we can provide that to you. And I think that's the reason I have some confidence in responding to Representative Barreto's scenario, that a court already has the tools that we're not touching with this bill at all to determine culpable mental state, and the court has latitude to take into account mitigating circumstances. I have no interest in getting folks into a catch-22 that are trying to follow all the existing laws. And I have a firm belief and confidence that a judge would take those type of circumstances into account and not reach a verdict in a way that would otherwise penalize a outfitter that's operating in good faith. I'm willing to work on that to the extent that we can find some comfort level for folks like yourself.
I appreciate that. Brief follow-up. Because the example, and it's not unique, the example that was brought forward qualifies under this law. He knowingly and willingly.
Well, it may.
Did that.
It may.
Well,
we have
based
to trust
on the arrest.
We have to trust our judges, though, and we do.
Sometimes we do.
Yeah, I don't say I always do, but Representative Esquivel, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this to me is, and you know me, I just send, take them out and walk them off a plank. But I think that we have a situation in place, and I'm going to tell you a little story about my uncle. My uncle was quite a great hunter. He had three mule deer within 36 inches on the inside, so he was a good hunter. Knew the deer. Well, he accidentally shot a doe one time because the doe was feeding in front of a buck, and he couldn't see the doe. But I asked him. I said, "Did you turn yourself in?" He said, "No." And my uncle was a straight arrow. And I said, "Why?" Because he said, "You don't know the state of mind of the police officer that comes out there. I could have either been arrested or they would have let a by, but he wouldn't take that chance." That's what I'm afraid of we're going to get with the guides. Because if you get some cowboy out there that doesn't understand up from down when it comes to hunting or fishing or whatever, then we might have a real problem with the guide. What's the guide going to do? Take a chance on what the judge is going to say? And I have a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm. Representative Esquivel, Chair Clem. Yes. My answer is yes. The guide should come forward and explain the circumstances. You know, we need to have an ethic in this state for our guides that they're squeaky clean. Mm-hmm. Our hunting and fishing guiding economy here depends on it. We cannot afford to have a reputation as a state where customers spend thousands and thousands of dollars sometimes on tags for big game, for example, and may be subjecting themselves to penalty because they have accidentally got themselves associated with a guide that is operating fraudulently or unethically and is willing to break the law. We're better than that. And our guides are better than that.
Representative Escobar.
You mentioned that someone may lose their license and get their license back and then go bank, make another infraction. Do you know of anyone that's done that?
Representative Escobar and Chair Clem, I think that our folks from the Marine Board can answer that. My fear about that mechanism, we do have that mechanism, but that over time, and this is sort of like a parole board in a way. If you're coming back time after time as an outfitter and you've committed crimes that should cause you to be out of the pool as a guide in this state, you know, people change its agencies, institutional memories fade, files get lost, and that mechanism may not work.
Follow up. You mentioned someone in East Central Oregon that was poaching mule deer, that was unlicensed. Him and his wife were receiving payment for that. I really don't know, or would hate to speculate, that those people would try to get a license in the first place. If you're a crook, you're a crook. And I don't think those people would even come forth to even try to get a license because they didn't in the first place. And the other thing is, if you were caught at that, I would assume that we would have some sort of a check and balance that wouldn't allow you to have a license anyway.
Representative Escobar and Chair Clem, you may be right about that one. But, you know, we don't write laws for the people that don't follow them.
You know? They won't follow them anyway.
Yeah. And I don't personally feel that... that's the approach we should take as legislators, is to not try to solve a problem simply because we have folks that don't respect the law.
Follow up?
So, yeah, let me ask a question. I'm just trying to understand the scope of, maybe it's even current law, for wildlife laws. For example, I don't know the right legal name for this charge, but failure to stay at your pole while it's in the water, would that qualify? So it's illegal to leave your pole in like a holder and go to the restroom. It's technically illegal. Would that qualify somebody if they got something as minor as that? Or failure to have your invasive species permit while you're out on a boat 10 feet or larger? I don't know if that's a wildlife law, but I'm trying to get a sense of, do we already have a categorization? We're talking pretty serious stuff, not ticky-tacky stuff, like your license fell in the water and then you still have 4 more miles on your float trip and you get pulled over and you claim it and the officer says, I don't believe you. You're getting a ticket. And this stuff happens, I can tell you for sure, because I've seen one happen to my nephew who was up using the restroom at the house, and the game warden came by and said, there's 5 guys and 6 poles. What's going on here? And he said, he's up at, it's going number 2, and we don't have a porta potty right here. And when he came, we're on poop today. So when he came back down, he said, I'm going to give you a warning, but next time he has to, you have to take the pole out of the water. It can't be sitting here while he's up using the restroom. So as long as we're not talking about that kind of stuff, I'm not as worried about how serious you throw at the book, because really what the bill does is take away discretion. It says if the Marine Board or somebody else hears the circumstances of the case, they can decide how long and how far to revoke. Well, what I'm reading is we're changing from, if you're convicted, meaning it changes to the judge has discretion, but the Marine Board no longer would. The Marine Board currently has discretion to hear the facts and levy something. This moves it to the judge has the discretion, and if the person pleads guilty not knowing because it's just a ticky-tacky ticket and loses their outfitter license. So to me, the scope of what wildlife laws means is really important.
Chair Clem, yeah, that is a fair articulation of the chain of command. Yeah, if in this narrow circumstance the judge finds that the wildlife laws have been intentionally violated by an outfitter, yes, it does. It steps over the Marine Board's authority and says that the judge shall revoke that license. That's because I think it's such a serious crime. And
which
granted,
crime, again, is what I'm getting at? Are we talking, again, walking away from your pole or poaching? Poaching, I'm with you. Walking away from your pole,
Well, it's... please be careful to committee to draw the distinction between getting a ticket or getting a citation or being arrested. And then what happens next? All of that information goes in front of a judge, and the judge's job is to fairly balance the facts.
But they don't always go in front of a judge. If you just pay the ticket, or is this bill only covering criminal things that would go in front of a judge?
It only applies where there is a judgment by the circuit court. So you have to go all the way through the process.
But if you just plead guilty by paying a ticket, is that the same thing as being judged guilty by the circuit court?
No, it's not my intent at all. Because
no, but is the bill...
And I'll double check on that, Mr. Chair. I'm happy. It is very much not my... I very much appreciate all of your caution about mistakes. But this is not about mistakes. And if the bill... has the potential to do that, I'll figure it out and eliminate that. These are in the narrow circumstances where we have a handful of outfitters, maybe one a year even, that just egregiously violates the rule, knows that they're doing it, and the court finds that they did that.
Let me get Representative Brocksmith in and then come back over here. Yeah. Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Helm, we've discussed this bill in the past, and just for the record, I really don't have a question, just a couple comments that I appreciate your previous work with Representative Krieger on these wildlife laws. Wayne, of course, spoke really highly of that work with you, and I appreciate this conversation and all the questions, and of course your willingness, as you mentioned, to Representative Springer and Representative Klim to vet and your commitment to fix these issues, because we're going to need to do that, I think, to make sure that everyone doesn't get in trouble when they're walking away from their pole or another aspect.
I mean, you should take it out of the water, technically. You shouldn't leave it in the water, because your fish is going to haul it downriver if you're too far away.
Of course.
But that's an expensive pole.
But I appreciate your willingness to work with us, Representative, on language to make sure that we can define what you want and what your intent is, so that we don't, as Representative Springer said earlier, judges have discretion, but sometimes people are swept up into a bad mix, and it could all be from the beginning of the process with the officer at the scene.
Okay, Vice Chair Springer, then we've got like six other people to testify who probably could illuminate the conversation as well.
Good. I hope that they can. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at the language and what we intend to do is oftentimes one thing, and what we end up doing is not always the same thing. And so, and I don't think you have anybody on this panel that thinks poaching is okay. Like I've said with cops, nobody dislikes a bad cop more than a good cop. Nobody dislikes poachers and is offended by poaching more than a respectable, ethical person who hunts and fishes. That said, I would need to have a conversation with LC before I could remotely get comfortable with this, because we're talking about convicted of a violation. Are we talking about violations? You have different classes. Are we talking
felonies
about
and misdemeanors? It applies to. Yeah.
Okay. I got a lot of questions before I could move forward that LC would.
We'll keep investigating these questions through the next witnesses and see where we're at after that. I think my annexation bills are probably not going to make it today, which is okay, but I have two gentlemen here from out of town, in one case for those, so I may stop at some point and just at least take your testimony. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Representative. Can I get Scott from the Marine Board, Randy, and... Do you want, who else was here from the Marine Board? Just Scott and Randy. The two of you, maybe ODF&W.
This is something that can be fixed.
Shannon.
Put lipstick on this pig. Too many openings.
Okay, let's have your testimony. I've got your written testimony here from the Marine Board, which was helpful because it describes three specific instances where somebody would go, what you guys did, and then what this bill would do. But please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. Randy Henry is with me as well. Randy's our boating safety manager and oversees the guide and outfitter program for the Marine Board. We did provide the written testimony, so I'm happy to answer questions. We did provide three examples that we thought would fit into, if this law were to exist, those folks would receive the lifetime suspension under this law. So we wanted to give you those examples if you want to discuss those as well. But we're happy to answer your questions.
So there's that middle one, the one that Representative Helm was alluding to from the newspaper story out in Bend. And so ODF&W has one. Are the two different penalties envisioned in these examples? And Shannon, you may not know what examples they're talking about, but they gave us a letter. It talked about, for example, in this trophy hunter, hunting guide who legally took trophy wildlife with intent, they received a court suspension of hunting privileges for 3 years, and then the board did the registration. So would ODF&W have prosecuted that or submitted that for prosecution? Because it's the court did the revocation. Is that how does that work if a license is going to be revoked within ODF&W?
Chair Klein, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Shannon Hearn with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. It would work two ways depending on the violation. One would be whether the person is going to receive a suspension of their license privileges to hunt and fish, and then it's the additional one on whether they can go for a guide certification. Mm-hmm. So if my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is if you're a guide and one of your hunters with a tag that you have under your guide license does it, you're automatically up for the review of the guide license certification.
That's but not the bill or current law?
Current law.
Okay.
But not always of your own hunting privileges.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Okay. But if somebody ends up, like in this case, the person did it themselves, then they have the Marine Board took a look at the situation, decided to revoke their license for 2 years. Is that the maximum amount of time you were able to do it? Like this whole question we had about rolling 2 years versus how long can you revoke if you want to, and at what interval do you check back in to see if you want to keep revoking?
So Chair Clem, Scott Bruin again. So we look at 24 months as the maximum. It says up to 24 months, or it directs us to revoke them for 24 months if there's a court order. So in the case where it's a three-year court suspension, we would revoke for 24 months, and then if they applied before that suspension was gone, there's still a year left in their suspension, we would deny for that year because they still have a court ordered suspension. So they would be able to reapply in 24 months based on how we read the law, but then we would deny if they reapplied for that 1 year. But that would be the max.
You don't feel like you could do the second year or the fourth year? Your suspension, you think, cannot go longer than whatever the termination of their hunting privileges was?
Correct. Well, unless it's less than 24 months that they that they were.
But you could not, once they've got their hunting licenses back, you can't just every 2 years say, nope, sorry, buddy, you're still suspended.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's, yeah. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you. So currently, regardless of this bill, currently, do we have any licensed guides in the state of Oregon that have been convicted of any fish and game violation?
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair Clem, Representative Springer. Yes, we do. Period. They are eligible.
Well, I need to have you say your name. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Randy Henry with the Oregon State Marine Board. We have instances where people have been convicted of wildlife crimes, and after that, 2 years.
And here they talk about three specific cases where they think they would have done wildlife suspensions. There's also 16 other guides that have been suspended, but that's not always for wildlife violations. That's just generally 16 guide certifications have been suspended in the last 3 years for all in total reasons.
Yeah, whatever. Chair Clem, for a little perspective on this, we have In the last 2 years, we've got 12 suspensions, and they are for everything from failure to disclose fish and wildlife violations on their application to actions against their U.S. Coast Guard license. So it sort of runs the gamut. We review all those types of things and their backgrounds. But again, that's a 2-year suspension maximum.
What I'm trying to figure out is, without this law, they can reapply for 2 years. We can do a lot of things. It doesn't mean we're going to succeed in that application process. I'm wondering if, without this law, if there is a window of opportunity, and I don't know that it's a loophole because it's the law and it allows it, can a person convicted of, let me generically say, serious wildlife crimes get a guide license? Are you going to give it to them? I mean, what do your ARs say as far as granting that license?
Chair Clem, Representative Springer, what's the word I'm looking for? We are held to that 2-year maximum. So after that point, we would issue, unless there was something new that came up, we would have to issue that license.
So they get a clean slate after 2 years, and background is not a criteria of...
We do not have discretion after that 2 years. That's what we are limited to in statute.
So yeah,
that might be a change.
These guys that you outlined here and were talked about in testimony, terrible experiences. I don't think they should even hunt again, quite frankly. Those were not accidents. So after 2 years, you have to give them a license?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Representative Springer.
And Vice Chair Springer, just to clarify, they might not be able to hunt themselves, but they would be able to guide hunters and anglers.
Because you can give longer...
Right, just to clarify, yeah.
License privilege bans or...
Yes. Chair Clem.
I don't like that.
Yeah, Chair Clem. One clarification. If a person has had their firearm privileges revoked for felony arrest, then we can condition or revoke... in those instances, we're required to under statute. So if it went that far, that's a different sort of measurement.
That's not even a lot
on that specific. Yeah. And do any of you have an opinion on the question I was asking about the scope of what is a conviction of a violation of wildlife laws? Is there a threshold, or is failure to have your license with you one, failure to stay with your pole and leaving it in the water? Is that all would be all covered under this bill?
Chair Clem, my understanding, if the term is violation, then it does include felonies and misdemeanors. So it would be the gamut.
If you get a ticket for anything.
It could be.
Yeah, technically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many members are on the Marine Board? Excuse me, sorry, I don't know this.
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, Scott Brown again. Of our board, we have 5 members.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up.
You mentioned earlier that there's 12 suspensions over the last 2 years. How many of those are outfitters or that would fall under, or guides that would fall under this bill?
Chair Clem, Representative Smith, when we looked back and sort of backcast and analyzed things that would rise to that level, we accounted for 3, as noted in the testimony. And that would include... these larger wildlife violations as well as some fishing violations, but fairly significant repeated violations.
So a quarter of the 12 are technically are guides and or outfitters.
3 or 12.
They would have. My question was, you mentioned earlier in testimony that there were 12 violations, suspensions over the last 2 years. How many of those 12 would be guides or outfitters that would fall under this law?
Chair Clem, Representative Smith, I believe that's correct. That's how I would.
It was 16. 16 guide certifications have been suspended since 2013.
Yes. So, Chair Clem,
how many of them? Sorry, I lost it too.
Yeah,
how many were wildlife, and how many were others? Or do you not know? Sorry, that's probably.
Yeah, I have the information, Chair Clem. I have the information in front of me. We have some basic registration violations, Coast Guard licensing violations, Fish and Wildlife violations, failure to disclose. So if they failure to disclose on their application, we take that very seriously. All of those, if their application indicates that they have had no violations, but when we do the Oregon Justice Information Network background check and we discover that indeed they did, then that's treated as false information and that's turned over to OSP to investigate. We have discretion there, so if it's a very minor thing like one fish over limit a year and a half ago, and we'll look at that and we'll do a conditional registration. If it's something that's much more egregious, then we'll do a suspension up to 2 years. So as a little bit of background.
So like three maybe.
Excuse me.
Yeah, yes. Trying to get to the answer here.
Yeah, can I follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
Have you read the bill?
Yes.
My question is, out of the 12 that you testified that were in the last 2 years that were suspensions, how many of those 12 suspensions would fall under the guides and outfitters language if this law were passed and become law? If this were law 2 years ago, how many of the 12 would fall under the jurisdiction of this law?
I think you want to look at your last, but they have it. It's in their written testimony. It's three.
Chair Clem, it's three.
And three out of 16.
Okay.
And the three are specifically the guy in Bend that Representative Helm talked about. Another one where a fishing guide received seven citations for Fish and Wildlife with intent. And then the third one was a fishing guide with two over limit violations in 3 years. And then the other 13 were something else.
And then, lastly, would it be better to look at the discretion issue, as it was brought up by earlier Representative Springer, with regards to allowing the Marine Board the authority to have a longer suspension than 2 years?
I know agencies aren't supposed to really have positions on bills, but we're asking you just for, you know, an opinion.
Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, what we look at is what the court does with these cases. So under 496.992, if there's a culpable mental state, that becomes a Class A misdemeanor. So we're kind of depending on the court to say we think this is the level that you're going to be. Our maximum is 24 months, so certainly if you said you can go up to whatever the court-ordered suspension is, then we could go up to that point. But, you know, we're looking at what the court orders and then within whatever discretion we have from there, we'll go from there. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It does.
Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, an observation here at this point that I think we've surfaced a number of problems with this bill.
I think so.
And frankly, for me, this is becoming painful to debate the weaknesses of the bill indefinitely. And
we have four more people to testify, too.
I think as Representative Springer has already said, there's not one of us here that wants to see poaching coming. I'm frankly very grateful to Representative Helm for bringing the issue forward. And I think even he himself mentioned that, you know, there's some improvements that he would like to see. Rather than debating something that I think we can all quickly agree to maybe has some faults at this point, if we allowed Representative Helm an opportunity to amend his bill and bring that back, I think we could have the most stunning little pig after he's put that lipstick on it that we could possibly imagine. So.
Okay, so I'm going to excuse you three. I just want to see quickly if, given what Representative Witt just said, which I agree with, Tom, Joe, Bob, do you all still want to come up and talk, or do you want to...
They've got written testimony.
We'll wait and engage. Either way is okay. And just, I only have room for three of you right this second, so hold on just 1 second.
So,
Chair, we'll have another chance on this bill again at another date, I'm sure.
I'll be very brief. Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. You have my written comments. I think, having known Representative Helm for a number of years, that his efforts on this bill are very sincere, and I hope that we can work through all the questions you have and that we could pass something that would deal with this and deal with the concerns you have. And that's my testimony. Thank you.
Chair Bob Olson, Northwest Steelheaders, just wanted to thank you for having this hearing. We represent a number of guides, and I think what I would say is that we really like the core concept behind this bill, which is to establish stronger penalties for guides who are serious offenders, and especially the ones that are repeat offenders. And so we look forward to working with the group to finalize this proposal.
Okay, Jeff.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rolliter. I live in Walport. I've worked on this sort of issue for a long time in this building, since 1980, in fact, with the idea of bringing professionalism into guiding. And when I was a little boy on the Columbia, or I grew up on the McKinsey, we looked up to the guides. And I think guides are still looked up to. They're examples. And I'd really like to work with Representative Helm and bring you back a bill that increases the professionalism but protects the constitutional rights of people to get a hearing and whatever else. So I don't think we want to put anybody out of business, but there are some guides out there that are really bad operators, and I'd like to see them not on the river. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Al, come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We support the concept. As you all know, poaching is a four-letter word for the Oregon Hunters Association. If we can get one step closer to stopping, we'll do that, and we'll work with the group on answering your questions. All the issues that you have brought up today have been raised by our board and discussions with about this bill and about similar bills. So we're all on the same page there. Mm-hmm. So we'll work to get it done. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2883. And only because, well, we've got enough time to talk about these a little bit probably here. And is Mike Salvaggio not here? Okay, so it's just Aaron and I as usual, and Jerry. So let me just describe these two bills to you all really quickly. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2039 and House Bill 2040. And because we've got an out-of-town guest, I'll start with 2040. I've just got to see which one it is. Find my bill. Sorry. What's that?
This the housing bill?
No.
No.
Maybe the wrong committee, maybe. Okay, so 2040. Okay, so this bill I generally refer to as non-remonstrance annexations, or the term I like to use is hostage annexation, because it's a loaded term. And specifically what we're trying to get at in this bill, and we've had this discussion a number of sessions now and trying to get the bill written correctly to deal with only the situation I'm describing. There are times where somebody will live in a county, not in a city. Their county will contract for services with the city, such as in Marion County. The county doesn't issue building permits in many cases. They will, instead of having two building permit offices, they'll just say, you know what, City of Salem, can we pay you to issue all the county building permits? So then somebody will go and want to remodel their bathroom, and they live in the county, not in the city. But the county doesn't offer any building permit services because it's cheaper to have the city do it, because there's not very many people who need them, so let's just have the city do it and pay them.
there have been circumstances in several cities where when a person from the who lived in the county, not in the city, was not on city services in any way, shape, or form, such as a sewer, a water system, they have no relationship to the city through service provision, have went into the city to utilize this city service that was being contracted for by the county, and the city said, we won't provide you your building permit unless you agree that you voluntarily will annex when we choose to annex you.
Contract annexation.
Yeah, non-remonstrance or contracts annexation, where you are not intending to hook up to any city benefits. If you're hooking up to city benefits, I have no problem with the fact they have the right to say, if you want on our water system, you have to agree to not fight annexation later. And the reason this is important is because once you have signed something saying you're not going to contest annexation, now you're presumed to be in favor of it, and many rights just disappeared for you to have elections, to have different kinds of appeals processes that you might, if you are in a hostile annexation where you don't want to be annexed and you've now just had to in order to get your bathroom remodeled. And most cities will say they never do this, but I in the past have dragged people in here who have had it happen to them and described it, and then usually they say, well, we don't do it anymore. Somebody did once do that, and it's slowed down. It may have slowed down. I fully hope so, because that's been part of the point of holding these hearings. But I don't know that it stopped. In Salem, it appears to have stopped. It was one overzealous person at the city desk, I think, that was doing it for a number of years. And the mayor at that time was kind of encouraging every means of annexation possible. And so I think she got excited on behalf of the mayor, and I believe it has stopped. But I have heard testimony from Washington County and other places where it does sometimes happen. So that's 2040. I'm not sure if I've got it written right. I'm sure Erin will point out flaws. I always try to get her and her team to work with me. They do their best, and then we usually disagree and the bill dies. So that could happen this time again, but I just want to flag the issue for everybody. 2039, this has to do with what's called island annexation. There's 13 different ways that annexations can be done by cities. One of them is called island annexation. And island annexation, rightly, is saying sometimes when you're annexing, there are people who don't get annexed for whatever reason, and they're in these little specks of like one house, two house, three house. And so when you're trying to provide services to the city, if you have little areas that are surrounded that are still in the county, but they're surrounded by the city. Now, the sheriff has to drive all the way through town to get to this one house. Kind of a little absurd. Other you know, things that would make sense to just serve the person, sort of absurd to have them all going all the way in. So we created a law a long time ago to say, whether those people like it or not, they can be annexed by a city council, even though they may not want it. They can be annexed because it's just causing too many problems for all the service providers. I'm okay with that. The part that is challenging for me is when cities use the island annexation method to take in thousands of people by calling it an island and having no size limit on the islands. And this came to light in my district when a former mayor was annexing roads and annexing properties and came in front of the legislature and said, I'm trying to surround this whole area of about 3,000 people. Once I get them surrounded, we can use the island method. And the committee chair said, why do you want to use the island method? She said, that's the only one where they're not allowed to vote. And he said, are you okay with that? And she said at the time, yes, because they come to me and say, please annex me, and I'm just trying to help them out. Well, I represent the area. I guarantee not all of them want to be annexed. In fact, very few of them do. So what I'm trying to do here is carefully craft something that says, if a city is voting on annexations as an electorate, not the cities where the city councils do the annexations, but there are some cities where they're voted on by the electorate. Salem is one of them. Only in those cities where they're being voted on by the electorate, there needs to be a limit to the size of that island that can be done using the island method. And if you're over the limit of that size, you need to use another method, such as the annexation plan method, which is what Ben did. Ben wanted to take in all these areas that were inside the UGB but not in the city. They did it in one big swoop. They got it passed, and now everything in the UGB has been annexed. In Salem, because they didn't think they could win the vote, they were going to use the island method, which was meant for little landowners that are just speckled throughout town to clean it up. They were going to take in the thing that's larger than most cities in Oregon and use a method that took away their ability to vote. When prior to 2007, island annexation voters didn't get to vote at all. In 2007 or 9, we changed the law and said the island voter should also get to vote. And the way this works, it sounds sort of unfair, but you know, it was all I could get past at the time. The island voter gets to vote, and then everyone in the city votes, and then they add them together, and whoever wins, wins. And that was all I could get through, but I took it. And so what this says is, if the island is under 100 acres, you still do it that way. If it's over 100 acres, you count the two separately. So it would have to pass in the city, which means the city would vote and a majority would say, yes, we want to pull that island into our city. It also has to pass in the island. And so it takes the island and becomes a double majority election if it's over 100 acres. If it's under 100 acres, you could still subsume the whole entire island. The reason I picked 100 acres is that was what Washington has for the limit on their island annexation law. I would have rather had like 10 or 20, but I'm trying to be somewhat reasonable here. So that's these two bills. And Jerry and Aaron, do you want to come up and chit-chat? We can continue this topic on another day, too, but I want to at least have Jerry talk because I know you drove up here from Eugene.
While they're coming up, Mr. Chair, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How do you keep the 100... If it's 250 acres, how do you keep, or 200 acres, how do you keep them from just do two separate islands?
They still have to create an island. There's a law about how you can create islands. They still would have to follow that law, which you can no longer have islands be constituted by more than 25% roads. So they would have had to annex, I could show you on a map, but they'd have to do a lot of tricky work to get two separate islands.
Well, because a lot of what they, you know, there's cherry stem annexation, yep, that occurs, mm-hmm, and so that's how they create these islands, right? Because they're cherry stemming these annexations geographically around them.
Right. It's a lot easier to do that when you can use a road to do a cherry stem, mm-hmm, because when you're doing house by house by house, you also then have to either have non-remonstrance agreements or other kind of methods in place. So anyway, that's my explanation. We're not going to end up getting through this today, I realize, but I at least wanted to talk and get some of the naysayers in because I like her. Jerry?
Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. We were formed in 1996 as a coalition of communities around the state dedicated to improving the public's input in annexation decisions and trying to be sure annexation law is fair. Those communities number about 30 right now. My testimony is going to be in reference to House Bill 2040. We sought some clarification on this bill. A little bit of history here. House Bill 2040, Representative Clem, as you mentioned, actually started some time ago. It began with our House Bill 2938 back in 2015, which was actually a more restrictive bill, and it got through the House 59-1, only to be sabotaged in the other chamber, but I won't go into that right now.
Yeah.
Our problem with the bill, first of all, again, this bill is designed, as you explained, and appreciate the explanation, to rein in what we call hostage annexation. It's called contract annexations, however you want to say it. But as we interpret Section 2, Paragraph 3B, this gives cities a way around the prohibition, because if a city has, as we understand this, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, if a city has within its IGA or its comp plan a requirement that you consent to annex, then this bill allows the city to ignore this prohibition, if we read this correctly. And we've got a problem with that, because it seems like that would defeat the whole purpose of the bill. 2938 in 2015 did not have these prohibitions, and it was readily approved. In our opinion, those qualifications on Section 2, Paragraph 3A, and certainly Paragraph 3B should be removed.
Okay.
And
yeah, I think it was a drafting error probably on my part.
Okay, so, you know, if we can do that, then we would enthusiastically support the bill for the following reasons. First of all, is the reason of lack of necessity for annexation. We have never seen a legitimate or a defensible argument for a city to demand annexation in the examples that you've given, Mr. Chairman. Next is the legal basis. And Mr. Chairman, you are aware of the Legislative Council opinion back in 2006, which states, and I quote, "A city may require consent to annexation only for delivering its own services, not for acting as an agent of the appropriate service provider." And for those unfamiliar with that, I have it here. I can leave it with your staff. I know, Representative, you're familiar with it. Fairness, why should cities, or why should citizens, in the example you gave, be forced to double their property taxes and face all kinds of assessments to just to get something like a building permit? And our final argument is history. I've talked about House Bill 2938. Again, it was a more restrictive bill. It sailed through the House 59-1. Some of you were involved in that. Hopefully you remember some of the particulars. It was subsequently treated very unfairly in the other chamber. This bill, if amended as we suggested, would be a similar bill, and we would hope it would gain similar support. Finally, we would also ask that you consider inserting the word new before the word water in Section 2, Paragraph 3C, to avoid another Lincoln City event. And in that case, that city had been providing water service extraterritorially for something like three decades and then suddenly demanded annexation if the service was to continue. We don't have a problem with a city if it's a new service. We've never advocated that they be denied to do that, a new city service. But we thought that that was a pretty unfair situation. If the word new is inserted before water, I think that would solve it for us.
Okay.
And I appreciate this opportunity. Thanks for your consideration. And if anybody wants to elaborate on the history, I'll be happy to do that offline.
Okay. Aaron, do you want to come back when you get more people and you're full time instead of being cut off?
Chair Clem, I was going to offer to do just that.
Yeah, why don't we do that? That way you get a real jury and not just my loyal compatriots who stuck it out with me till then. Okay, so I'm going to carry it over to next time and we'll just start with that if that's okay. Yes, I'm going to carry over House Bills 2039 and 2040. And anything else for the good of the order? Okay. All right, I'm going to adjourn the committee. Thank you. Adjourn the committee. Thank you. All right, I'm going to adjourn.